As heroin addiction rises across the country, a Mexican operation controlling many small American cities operates like a mainstream delivery business. Its dealers keep low profiles, they don't carry guns, and they rely on customer satisfaction for repeat business. Journalist Sam Quiñones traces this heroin business from its roots in the deceptive marketing of prescription painkillers in the 1990s. That created new addicts who could satisfy their drug craving more cheaply with black tar heroin from dealers based in the city of Jalisco, near Mexico's Pacific coast. Sam Quiñones says the epidemic has devastated entire middle American communities while bringing wealth to a dismally poor region of Mexico. Sam Quiñones takes us to what he calls dreamland after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. With open-air drug markets controlled by violent gangs, street corner shootings, and a high rate of addiction, Baltimore's heroin trade looks like a textbook example of urban pathology. But our next guest, journalist Sam Quiñones, has a different story about the heroin trade that is both fascinating and disturbing. It's about a small group of impoverished farmers and laborers from the Jalisco region of Mexico, who have flooded smaller cities and towns of middle America with cheap black tar heroin, avoiding big urban areas and their drug gangs. The Jalisco boys first identified communities where there was no competition. Then they set up operations with a business model that could have been drawn from Amazon or Domino's Pizza. They stress aggressive pricing, sophisticated marketing, convenience, and above all, customer satisfaction. Addicts phone in their orders, arrange a meet, and drivers deliver a reliable, consistent product. Unlike urban drug gangs, the Jalisco boys keep a low profile. They don't carry guns. They drive nondescript cars and dress to blend in with the local Mexican population. Their clientele is typically white and suburban. Addicts who first got hooked on prescription painkillers, which is a big part of this story. The Jalisco boys offered black tar heroin with a similar chemical makeup to those painkillers. Sam Quiñones writes that black tar heroin has ruined thousands of lives in the United States, ripping apart once thriving blue-collar towns. At the same time, it's pulled the poor out of poverty back in Mexico. Sam Quiñones is a reporter whose work has appeared for the Los Angeles Times for more than a decade, concentrating on Mexico and border issues. He's the author of two previous books, True Tales from Another Mexico, and the second book, Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream. His latest book is Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic. It's not a simple tale, and Sam Quiñones tells it very well, talking to the American addicts and families whose lives were ruined, as well as the producers and sellers in Mexico who saw drugs as an alternative to a life of grinding poverty. I want to welcome Sam Quiñones to the Midday Show here at WYPR in Baltimore.
It's great to be here. Thanks very much for having me, Dan.
Yeah, and thank you for explaining this big question that I've had, You know, on our program here and my work at the Baltimore Sun, I've spent a lot of time thinking about and reading about the heroin epidemic. And it is, I think, by every measure, we are in the middle of an epidemic. Just some numbers here, you know, more than 8,000 deaths due to heroin a year. That's a tripling of the number in just the last 3 years.
Right.
We also have the number of deaths each year from prescription painkillers like OxyContin that's more than doubled. I mean, we're in this. If you take cigarettes and alcohol away, this would be the single worst drug plague ever. Those are your words from your book.
Right, I think so. And what's also different this time, as opposed to previous incarnations of the heroin plague back in the 70s in particular, is that this one is almost everywhere in the country. It's amazing. I've been getting calls from people from remarkable parts of the country. You just don't ever think of heroin in Iowa or heroin in Tennessee I was just in northern Kentucky, near Cincinnati, south of Cincinnati, across the river, and a horrible heroin problem there. Seattle, the suburbs, very wealthy places. Charlotte, the area around Charlotte, North Carolina, and into northern South Carolina. That's really, I think, what's different this time around as well. And the reason for that, I think, is, as you said in your introduction, that there's the pills are got there first. You know, this idea that these pills, a lot of your listeners will know, Vicodin, Percocet, Oxycontin, et cetera, were somehow okay to prescribe for almost any pain and in huge amounts because they were deemed virtually non-addictive by certain pain specialists and pain experts, is kind of what happened first. And they convinced doctors that this was the case. And that's why we have heroin in those states that I mentioned, where, of course, you never would have had heroin ever before.
Correct. I mean, when I think about the word heroin and the connotation that has for me, having grown up in the 70s, 80s, and then come to Baltimore here, work as a journalist, I mean, associated with using needles, associated with abandominiums, vacant houses, people nodding off on park benches, no way to live, a horrible life, friends telling about, experiences with family members who just seemed lost or homeless. And
that's still true. I mean, it does not have a lesser effect on people today than it ever did. The difference is now where it's having that effect. It's having that effect in rural towns. I just was in northern Kentucky. There's a town called Falmouth where it's a town of 2,000 people, you know, surrounded by wheat and tobacco farms and this kind of thing. They had a flood in 1997. Pretty much destroyed a lot of the town. The people who had lived in the town for generations sold their properties, and the town became a town of absentee landlords, largely. A lot of new folks moved in. Nobody knew each other. The jobs had gone, and about this time, the opiate problem ignited and basically became a horrible problem for this little town in the middle of 50 miles south of Cincinnati. And it's a story that repeats over and over. And it's rural areas, it's suburban areas, principally, I would say, now. I think, in fact, leaving Baltimore and Philadelphia, D.C. and New York aside, I would say that heroin is actually far greater problem in rural and suburban areas than it is in the urban areas now.
Just one last thing from me on that. I just thought that fear would keep people away from it. I mean, the connotation I had of heroin was this is something you didn't experiment with because you'd...
Yeah, of course, but once you've got pills, once you're addicted to pills, these pain pills, people don't understand, and it isn't explained to them properly, I believe, that the drugs in those pills, the active drugs in those pills, hydrocodone and oxycodone, these are opiate derivatives, synthesized opiates, and they are molecularly almost identical to heroin. They cause the same euphoria. They have the same effect on the brain, and they have this. They create the same withdrawals, and so they are, in for all intents and purposes, just heroin. They just happen to be combined with other drugs, usually that limit their effect sometimes, but there's almost no, and so once you're addicted to those, and as particularly as your tolerance grows and grows and grows to very large amounts of dope a day, and then, of course, in order to get the maximum bang for your buck, you start shooting it into your veins with needles. At that point, there's no, you've crossed the Rubicon. You're not gonna, you don't have, the stigma of needles is no longer a problem for you, and going to heroin then, just simply as an economic measure of just paying less money for your daily habit. Is almost essential for these folks. It's perceived as, quote unquote, a no brainer. You know, of course you would switch to heroin because the price is a fifth of what the pills are in the streets.
Okay, so we've established this from your research, from your reporting, Sam Quiñones, that the ultimate driving force behind this epidemic is this. Are the painkillers? Is the pharmaceutical companies have not been able to come up with a non-addictive drug that can
right.
control
That's part
chronic
of the story,
pain, right?
Precisely. That was part of the story initially, that medicine was trying to find a painkiller that would not addict people. We had these fabulous painkillers, but they were highly addictive in the form of opium and morphine and heroin and other derivatives out of that. And they instead of finding a drug that didn't addict people, what they said was, we believe these drugs now are no longer addictive. They just kind of decided that in the 1980s and into the 1990s, there was a growing conventional wisdom that these pills, when used to treat pain, very important caveat, when used to treat pain, these pills were no longer addictive. Less than 1% of patients got addicted, virtually non-addictive. These were the buzz phrases that were thrown around during that time. And that is how they convinced hundreds of thousands of doctors nationwide to prescribe them in massive quantities. There was this movement afoot on the part first of pain specialists, people who really believed that we needed to treat pain and it was a serious, serious problem. And they were right. It was a serious problem. But the solution was to just kind of blast opiate painkillers at the population without taking into account who might be getting them and how many pills they might be getting. And then along with that came Purdue Pharma, the company that made OxyContin in 1996 and marketed that drug for about 6 years. They were allowed to market that drug as if it were an over-the-counter medicine to doctors. They were pushing it with phone pads and pens and hats and trips to Scottsdale and to Florida and then also there was a CD called Swing in the Right Direction with OxyContin, which featured a bunch of swing band tunes, you know, Count Basie and Woody Herman. All of this was an idea to tell doctors, hey, prescribe these pills for all manner of pain. It used to be that those drugs were only used for terminal cancer patients. Now the idea was, hey, if you have a patient who just had a wisdom tooth out, prescribe Vicodin, you know, prescribe these pills for all manner of pain, chronic pain especially. Huge numbers of people suffer from chronic pain, far larger than the market for terminal cancer patients. So that was the push. The pain specialists started this idea. The pharmaceutical companies, particularly Purdue Pharma, the manufacturers OxyContin, picked that idea up and ran with it heavily with massive sales force and, you know, out there all across the country. And with that, over a period of 10 years, they convinced many, many, many doctors. Most of medicine in America was convinced that these pills we now knew were no longer addictive when used to treat pain. It was nonsense. Truly nonsense. They had gotten this idea from a few very poorly written little snippets in the medical literature and expanded those and blown those way out of proportion, way out of context. But that was the idea. They were joined then by this idea in American medicine that pain was now the fifth vital sign, that you had to measure pain the same way you would blood pressure or something like this. We had to treat pain. It was not just a good idea to treat pain. It was almost a legal duty, and people were sued for not prescribing enough of these pills, et cetera. The problem was that they didn't take into account each individual standing in front of them. And does that person have addiction in his background? Was his grandfather an alcoholic? Does that person smoke marijuana, et cetera? There are a million little questions like this that could make it a problem. And what happened was a lot of people were very well served by these pills. It's true. They were served. A lot of people with chronic pain were very well served. But there was a whole other population that was susceptible to addiction, who got really hooked on these and badly throughout the 90s and well into and into the last decade.
By the time we get to 2007, the Purdue Pharma, that company you mentioned, which owned the patent to OxyContin, executives of that company ended up pleading guilty to misbranding the drug. They were fined millions, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right, and it didn't make a difference at all, as far as I can tell, on their sales. It's a private company, but my understanding is they still sell $2 or $3 billion worth of OxyContin a year. The owner, the last remaining of three brothers who bought the company in the 1950s, when it was a laxative company, it was a nothing kind of company, is now one of the wealthiest men in America, all due to the sales of OxyContin years after that lawsuit. Or that criminal suit, rather, was brought against the the top three executives of the company. And yes, they pleaded guilty, and the company was forced to pay $634 million in fines, $34 million which was paid by the top three guys. And they kept on selling. They'd stopped their marketing, the marketing that they had been using, this very aggressive marketing to doctors was halted, and they did reformulate OxyContin in 2010 to make it more difficult to abuse, but the pills. But doctors clearly are wedded to opiates as a way of solving pain, and one big part of the collateral damage of all that is the hundreds of thousands of opiate addicts we now have in the country, and a whole lot of people dying now from heroin.
And that sets up the next part of the story, black tar heroin. Sam Quiñones is our guest. Sam, we'll take a break here and come back. We'll pick up the story there. And we'll also tell you about the title of Sam's book, Dreamland, and what that means when we get back. The true tale of America's opiate epidemic. Bloomsbury Press is the publisher of Sam's book. This is Midday, a short break. We'll be right back. And this is the Midday Show. Dan Rodrigues here, speaking with Sam Quiñones this hour, California journalist and author most recently of Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic. This is a fascinating tale about a drug operation you've probably never heard of, based in a small city in Mexico you've probably never heard of, that controls the heroin trade in a remarkable number of small cities and towns across the heartland of this country, many of which you've probably never heard of either. I'll mention one, Portsmouth, Ohio. You might have heard of Portsmouth, Ohio. But Portsmouth, Ohio, that's what gets us, Sam, to the title of your book, Dreamland. Why don't we go to Portsmouth, Ohio, before we head off to Mexico?
Yeah. As I got into this story, I realized that several towns were crucial, pivotal things in the tale. One of them was the town of Portsmouth, which is on the Ohio River across from Kentucky. It's a classic Rust Belt town now, but for many years it was a glorious industrial town, a real pride of America, basically. They had a steel factory there. They had shoe factories and a variety of other things that kept a lot of those towns, about 50,000 people. No one was wealthy, but everyone kind of had enough. And there was a vibrant community life. The main street was really bustling. People felt at home. People left their, you know, classically left their car doors unlocked at night. And the center of life was this enormous swimming pool, about the size of a football field, probably one of the largest swimming pools in America. And it was really where life itself took place. It was a strange thing to realize as I got into the story. You know, if you were young, you were a toddler, you were at the shallow end of the pool. By the time you're in high school, you're jumping off the diving board at the deep end and showing off for your girlfriends or whatever. And by the time you had children, you'd have children, you'd bring them back to the shallow end, and life would continue that way. People watched each other grow up in public. It was a very egalitarian place because everybody kind of looked the same in a swimming suit. You know, no one, the plant manager and the line worker all looked pretty much the same. And the name of this pool was Dreamland. That was the name they gave it. And it seemed to me kind of almost a metaphor for the country. There seemed always to be more room for everybody. And people, again, didn't feel weren't wealthy, but they felt well off because things could be done in public that were cheap. Everyone played outside. There was the pool itself was quite cheap to be a member of. And all of this begins to collapse with the 1980s and the Reagan Revolution, basically, and the demise of the steel factory, probably a long time in coming, happens in 1980. Other factories begin to leave. The town's population cuts in half. Main Street empties. And finally, in 1993, sadly, Dreamland, this glorious pool that kept life kind of sustained, life in the town, is plowed under and literally replaced by a big parking lot. That's what stands where Dreamland is now. That's what is there now, where Dreamland once stood. And so this is kind of I took as kind of a metaphor for what happened to many small towns where heroin addiction took place. Because once you have destroyed community, once you have shredded the girdings of community, then what you get is yourself. You're very vulnerable to a drug that turns everybody into this kind of self-absorbed, narcissistic, kind of siloed individuals. And that's really what happened in Portsmouth. Opiates made short work of that town once all the girdings of community were destroyed. The reason I focused on it was it became the town that had the most pill mills. As this pill revolution took place, another part of the story was that these pills, doctors began, a few scandalous doctors, I think a relatively small number, but still very notorious guys, began having clinics where there would be long lines, and they would just basically sell prescriptions. You know, they'd get $250 every month. You had to show up, you get your prescription, and they would give you a cursory review. Are you in pain? Yeah, I hurt back here. Okay, here you go, and you're out your door. And there's five-hour lines out the door, and people and these doctors making tons of money. The place where that pill mill model was invented was Portsmouth, Ohio, and from there it spread. But it seemed to me crucial because this was a story of how opiates get started in America. Really, it's not an opiate addiction gets started in America. It's when you lose community, when you lose those things that kind of bind us all together. That's when this kind of drug can make the greatest inroads.
You know, someone on Twitter who saw what we were going to be talking about today made a comment like that about loss of industry, loss of jobs, loss of the center of small towns, small cities. I grew up near a small city in Massachusetts, and I remember what happened when we lost the downtown. Well, we lost industry, shoemaking, sure, in that particular town, and we lost the downtown. It's never really recovered. It's become a kind of a ghost town.
Yeah. Exactly. Dreamland was literally replaced by Walmart as the center of social life. Now where people go to see each other is the Walmart. Really, it's down the road about a mile, and there's no other place to kind of get together and meet and be a community in that town, and that struck me. That was like the it was just laden with metaphor as I was in there, and yes, exactly. Many towns all across the country have suffered this. I would also say, though, what I found interesting was as I began to tour America trying to understand this problem and understand the story, what I found was that there was the same lack of community in wealthy places too. It was they had jobs and they had everything. They weren't on SSI or unemployment, but there was no greater sense of community. People still lived quite isolated from each other, even with the same family, a large house. The children would live in their private bedrooms and then be on the internet all day long, and the families wouldn't be outside. The streets were empty. The parks are empty, and so it didn't seem the connecting tissue in all this, I guess you might say, from Portsmouth, a very poor town now, to maybe Charlotte, North Carolina, quite wealthy area, is just simply a corrosion of community, of being in together in public and on a regular and organic basis. And that's how this drug gets started.
Mm. Now we'll switch to Xalisco. And I'm going to just spell it for my listeners so they have this in mind as we talk about it. Xalisco, Sam Quinones. So take us now to Xalisco and make that connection.
It's Jalisco.
Jalisco, sorry.
Pronounced with an H. No, no problem. I'll tell you how I found this story was that I was working at the time for the LA Times on a team of reporters talking about Mexican drug trafficking. My idea was to cover how Mexican drugs were trafficked across the United States. Not across the border, but once they got here, how they made their way across the United States.
Right.
I came to a series of stories about Huntington, West Virginia. Small town, again, on the Ohio River, quite poor and quite, battered by the Rust Belt phenomenon. But there, I noticed a number of people in 2007 had died in a six-month period from overdoses of black tar heroin, and that made no sense to me at all. First of all, why was there any heroin demand in West Virginia, a state I did not associate with heroin. Number two, what was black tar heroin doing? Now, black tar heroin is a very specific kind of heroin. In our hemisphere, it's only made in Mexico. It's a rudimentary, semi-processed form of heroin, just as addictive, just as euphoric, just as powerful as white powdered heroin or any other kind of heroin. It just doesn't happen to be processed as much. It's only made in Mexico, and my understanding was from years of studying and writing about Mexico and drug trafficking, was that black tar heroin was only on the western side of the United States. So what was it doing east of the Mississippi River was my question. So I call up a guy. I call up a DEA agent in Columbus. I talk to the Huntington cops. They say, no, all our dope comes up from up there in Columbus, so talk to them. I call up a DEA agent there in Columbus, and he said, you know, 10 years ago, we had no heroin. No heroin in Columbus, Ohio, 10 years ago, say 2000, 2001, roughly, is when I was talking. And he says, but then about that time, a bunch of Mexican guys show up and they have this system that I, as a longtime narcotics officer, I've never seen before in my life. It's like a pizza delivery system for heroin. So an addict will procure this phone number, which are distributed outside methadone clinics and various other places. Call the operator. The operator's standing by, ready to take your order. The operator has at his disposal three or four drivers, all of whom are circulating from 7 in the morning till 7 at night with balloons of heroin in their mouths, little tenth of a gram doses of heroin in their mouths. He'll dispatch one of those guys to wherever the addict is closest to, say a Burger King parking lot, for example, some public place, and they'll meet. And usually it's close to where the addict lives or hangs out or what have you. And they'll meet. And they will consummate the deal. The guy will spit out, five balloons of heroin. Here you go. The addict pays, and he's on his way. And that happens over and over and over again all day long in Columbus. The guy was telling me, we have arrested these guys repeatedly, and they send up new ones. Every time we arrest one, they send up a new guy maybe like at most a week later. They don't use guns. They look really low profile. They look like the day laborers in front of some Home Depot. They don't shoot. They don't cause problems. They're really low profile. And then he told me this thing that kind of changed my life for the next several years. He said, and they're all from the same town. Now, my background in all this was that I had lived in Mexico, and I'd written two books about Mexico, and I had been to many, many small Mexican towns where immigration really takes place. And I had seen this phenomenon before, everybody in one town doing the same job. And the reason for that is that people in Mexico, working class poor people in Mexico, do not have access to the kind of education that would turn the son, say, of a campesino into a mechanical engineer. They just don't have access to that. So without access to proper education, you learn your trade from those around you. So if somebody in your village is a construction worker, pretty soon everybody's a construction worker. In my first book, I wrote a story about a village where everybody makes popsicles and has started popsicle businesses all across Mexico, thousands of them. There's another story that I'm trying to do about a town in Mexico where literally everybody is a pimp. Everybody pimps and they sucker in innocent, naive country girls and then traffic them to Queens, New York. That's their that's the job of this one town, literally exists. So when he said one town, I thought small village because it's the small village connections that make those things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes back on the phone. He says, yeah, a guy told my agent told me they're all from Tepic in the state of Nayarit. Nayarit is a very small state on the Pacific coast, down from Arizona, maybe about 12 hours. But when he told me Tepic, I knew that was incorrect. Tepic is the capital city of that state. It's 350,000 people. And I knew it did not jive with my experience that they would all come from a big capital city. They have to come from a small town. And that sent me back to a long list of people that they'd arrested, and I wrote to them. I began writing to these guys and saying, you know, do you want to talk? Do you want to tell your story to a reporter? You know, and most guys didn't even answer. One guy, though, got back to me, and he said, yes, you're right. They are not. We're not from Tepic. Tepic's the capital city. Nobody's from there. We're all from a town not too far away called Jalisco. Jalisco's 25,000. The county itself, it's the county seat of a small county of about 45,000. Little villages all around there. Every man who comes to the United States from that town or those little villages traffics heroin. And at first I thought he meant traffics heroin to Columbus. I thought, interesting story. One town's connection to Columbus, you know, interesting story. So I'll write about it. But then he begins to say, oh, no, no, no. They're all over the country. They're Minneapolis, Indianapolis, Seattle, and Portland, and Reno, and Albuquerque, and Boise, and Charlotte, and Nashville, and Memphis. And he goes on and on and on. I'm like, I was blown away. Right then, I was just stunned. Like, this one town, it's impossible to know how much, what percentage of the heroin these guys provide to the United States, but it's got to be huge. And then I asked him, well, then why aren't they? I literally asked him, why aren't they in New York and Baltimore? Because what I knew was the big heroin markets were still that corridor from New York down, mm-hmm. Down to where you guys are. He says, no, they never go to Baltimore. They never go to. They're scared of New York City.
So they avoid the big cities. They avoid big cities.
They avoid big cities because the big cities have entrenched gangs who have guns.
Right. Okay. So
they don't want to be messing with that stuff.
Here's a question for you. How did the farmers of, pronouncing it now correctly, Jalisco, figure out that there would be a market for this black tar heroin? How'd they figure that out?
That was a fascinating tale as well. As I got into it, I discovered there was one guy in particular, one man, who in 1992 had made a partnership with one of these Jalisco boys. He was actually from San Fernando Valley in L.A. They met in prison. They form a partnership when they both get out of prison, and they begin to work together, and they set up what they call these little organizations. They call them stores, tienditas, stores. They set up a store in Reno and Portland. But finally, he wants to go out on his own. He's a Mexican-American guy. He's now virtually adopted by the folks in Jalisco. He owns property, has a wife down there, all that kind of stuff. He then, in 1998, says, I'm going to go out on my own. And he heard from a guy in a Reno casino that if he took this dope that he had sold to this man to Columbus, Ohio, he would make a killing. He would make $1 million. And so in 1998, June 11th, in fact, of 1998, literally peg the date, he crosses the Mississippi River, lands in Indianapolis, stays in Indianapolis maybe a week or so, doesn't really like it for a lot of reasons I go into in the book, goes to Dayton, doesn't really like Dayton for other reasons I go into in the book, and then finally in 1998 ends up in Columbus. Roughly July or August of 1998, ends up in Columbus, Ohio, just as there's this big explosion in the prescribing of pills, opiate painkillers, on the part of doctors, and they're all buying the idea that these drugs are virtually non-addictive. And all of this is happening especially in the area in which Columbus is kind of like the northern area. The ground zero for all this is Columbus to the north, maybe Cincinnati to the west, West Virginia, eastern Kentucky.
That's where those pill mills are, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And he figures out that talking with addicts and talking with people, because he can speak English, that's the thing that he brought to the table. He knew the addict world. He was a longtime addict himself. He knew the addict world. He knew methadone clinics. He spoke English. He figured out that if he just hung out and kept selling his heroin, that eventually so many people would be addicted to these pills. Who were addicted to these pills would be eventually switching to heroin because they were almost the same drug. He figured that out, and from that point on, this system from Jalisco just has thrived throughout that region.
But what about, Sam, what about the black tar heroin was so special? In other words, it was so identical
to... I think had he sold any other kind of heroin, it had the same impact. The difference was that they had a system for selling it.
Okay.
They had a system that was relentless. It was all about customer service. It was all about convenience. We'll deliver it to you. Remember, these were mostly white kids who were getting addicted. They didn't want to go down to Skid Row to buy their dope. They didn't want to go some evil drug house. They would go to Burger King and get their dope delivered there. So black tar heroin was what they had access to. The importance of black tar was they had access to the poppies.
Right.
And they had access to, they knew how to make it.
What were those farmers doing before they were growing those poppies?
The farmers who make the poppy are different from the guys from Jalisco. The farmers who grow the poppy grows very nicely in the mountains of Mexico and has done since the Chinese immigrants brought it over in the 1910s or 20s. But that's a different group. The folks from Jalisco buy the opium goo that the farmers in the mountains harvest from the poppy. They buy that goo in wholesale, you know, in large quantities, and they cook it into black tar heroin down in Jalisco. They don't actually grow the stuff, but they do know how to cook it with a variety of other chemicals into heroin, into black tar heroin. That makes them kind of the controllers of the supply,
right,
which is a big part of the story as well.
So if you were to go back 20 or 30 years, those same people or their ancestors, their fathers or grandfathers, would have been just working the land? Or they would have been
subsistence farmers?
And
all the first pioneering guys in all this, beginning in the 1980s and 1990s, they were not subsistence farmers. That was the interesting thing. A lot of these guys who first started it were actually pretty well off by standards relative to those that region. You know, they had land. A lot of them were sugarcane farmers or coffee bean farmers. But their kids, the ones who started this business, heroin business, kind of, you know, wanted more. They didn't want to work so hard. And they wanted maybe more adventure or something like that. And so a lot of the first families that I know of who started this were actually from families that had land, had horses, had houses, which was and which was in stark comparison to a lot of the other families who were kind of at the bottom of the rung who did not. But the folks who started this, and particularly in the 80s, and crucially, the folks who expanded this, because what happened is these guys come with a kind of a more entrepreneurial sense to drug trafficking. They start in San Fernando Valley, where they all begin to congregate, and it gets saturated. So some of them, a few of the more adventurous, begin to branch out. And this is in 1989, 90, 91, 92. They begin to branch out to other towns, San Diego, Portland, Oregon, Honolulu, Reno. And pretty soon everyone realizes, hey, just look for a virgin territory, you know. And eventually the big expansion comes in the 90s as these guys realize, hey, we could sell this anywhere because this system is fantastic. And at the same time, they realized that they had to move out because in every town they would go to, this was pre-pills, remember, in the early 90s, every town they would go to, the population of addicts was really stagnant. It was not growing because it was just the same old addicts who had been addicted for 10, 15 years. And so these guys would come and they would steal clients from each other. That was the way you gained your market share. You just steal a client from somebody else. And how'd you do that? Offering them better service, better dope, cheaper dope, all that kind of stuff. So they learn these lessons, and then they transplant all that system to an area like Columbus and the Midwest, where pills are just then exploding, and the numbers of addicts are going through the chart, through the roof. And at that point, that system, combined with this new addiction to opiate pills, creates this problem in those areas, particularly back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, that really has not left the area.
Sam Quiñones is our guest, a journalist and author who writes about life in Mexico and the experience of Mexicans in the U.S. His latest book is called Dreamland, a look at a drug cartel that he's been describing that came to control the drug traffic, heroin traffic, in much of America's heartland. Dreamland is the name of Sam's book, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. A short break. We'll be right back. Fascinating story Sam Quiñones has here in Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. So, Sam, I've got two or three questions here I want to ask you in the time we have remaining. One is, how did all this change Jalisco and the people in Jalisco? It sounds almost like they had a town meeting or something and said, everyone from Jalisco is going to be involved in this. We're all going to make a ton of money.
No,
you go to Des Moines, you go to San Jose, you go to, right?
Here's what, that's a very interesting question. That is exactly what did not happen. Because in these small towns, this is why I understood this to be a small town phenomenon. These small towns, nobody gets along. They're all cousins. Everyone's related. There's like vast webs of extended family, but nobody gets along. There's all this kind of heavy competition, and once somebody gets ahead a little bit, everyone's like jealous, and so, but once you go back with a new car, or once you build a house in 9 months that normally would take you 10 years to build, pretty soon everybody wants to get on this. And once people understood the potency of this. One thing that struck me was, in my travels across Mexico, I've been to many, many villages where everyone had migrated to the United States. And one of the things you always see is rebar sticking out of the houses, the tops of the houses. And that's because nobody has enough money to build their house immediately. So they build a piecemeal over a period of 8, 10, 15 years. And they leave the rebar sticking up because they're thinking, someday I'll build a second story
right,
on top of this.
Right,
okay?
Right. Yeah, see.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, in Jalisco, Jalisco is the one town where I know a lot of migration to the United States takes place where I saw no rebar.
Right.
So that to me tells me that heroin just changed the economic landscape. And in fact, talking with people in the town, what happened with heroin balanced the social scales. Before, there was the, you know, in a village, which you and I would both consider quite poor, there still was a kind of a hierarchy where the butcher, who was better off than, say, the landless sugarcane day worker, would treat the wife of that day worker like crap because she knew the woman was going to ask him for credit, so he would speak sharply to her. But once their son, that day worker's son, goes to the United States and drives heroin around the streets of Denver or Reno or Portland or Columbus for a while and sends that money home, all of a sudden that woman is worthy of respect. And that's what happens to a lot of those families over a period of time, because it started out with the families who are fairly well-to-do by those standards. But then because the labor demands of this system were so great, it absorbed huge numbers of young men. Hundreds and hundreds of guys went into the heroin driving business in the United States from this county and from surrounding areas. And it lifted and so it's kind of righted the social scales. And for the first time, I remember this one guy telling me, when I went home for the first time with all that money, I had $15,000 in my pants pocket. Never had that kind of money ever in my life. He was the first one from his tiny little miserable neighborhood that was so poor and benighted in a little village outside of Jalisco to go into the plaza in Jalisco and buy the beer for everybody for an entire night from like 8 p.m. until 7 a.m. Nobody from his town had ever done that. It was like this radical thing. Of course, guys, young men see this and they say, I want some of that. All the girls want to talk to this guy. This guy comes home with, you know, brand new hat, brand new belt buckle, brand new Levi's 501 jeans, which are kind of like a special kind of rural menswear gold standard back then. And all of a sudden, that is the a recruiting poster, if you like. Everybody wanted to raise their hand at that point and say, I'll do this job. Hell yeah.
Right.
And it changed the social dynamics of the town, as well as, you know, infusing it with a lot of cash.
Why no violence? Why were they able to sustain
yeah.
this? Because, you know, I ask you, Sam, because here we are in Baltimore, and one of the biggest problems we have with heroin, the heroin trade. I mean, addiction causes its own sets of social problems, but we have violence associated with it.
Precisely.
Competition,
Yeah. And that's the difference. That's Mexican cartels and Mexican traffickers just in general, as bloody as they may be in Mexico, tend to avoid it down up here. And you can see Juarez had 3,000 murders a year not long ago, and El Paso, right across the river, had 20. You know, nobody that they don't tend to do that. But in this specific case, there were several very good reasons for it. First of all, again, getting back to the small town nature of this business model, you couldn't shoot your competitor because he might have been the guy you went to kindergarten with, and his brothers know where your mom lives back home.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, you were kind of friends with them. And on top of that, this system worked on salary. So you get paid $300, $400 a week to drive around the streets of Albuquerque with your mouth packed with balloons of heroin. What do you care how much you sell? You just deliver. You don't care. So you're not interested in expanding the business necessarily, which might require you to start shooting. Plus, these guys were none of these guys were thug, cartel killer types, career criminals. They were all farm boys, sugarcane farm boys. A lot of them were like butchers or bakers or construction workers, dead-end jobs mostly in Mexico that they saw reprieve from through this heroin driving business. So on top of that, everybody knows, it's first lesson you learn, if you're an illegal immigrant in the United States, you get pulled over by the cops, they're going to deport you. If you're an illegal immigrant with a gun, you get 10 years in federal prison. That's a big, big motivation never to have any weapons. But also, it was a competition among people who knew each other. Now, there were tiffs and there were problems, and occasionally people would die back in Jalisco. But I'm unaware of, and with one exception, I'm unaware of anybody ever killing each other over routes. They also they realized that if we just keep selling this stuff, there's enough for everybody, and they basically were correct. And also, gunplay attracts police attention, and that's right. The last thing, far worse than any problem we might have with each other, is the attention of police departments. We have a system where people, they kind of intuitively realize they had a system that that portrayed them as small, humble, you know, no account street dealers. They never had a lot of cash. They never had any guns. They had small apartments with nothing in them. And so it was the opposite. They were the opposite of what every cop, every reporter, every mayor,
was looking
every
for.
Member of the public yeah. thought of as a massive yeah. Network of traffickers. And in fact, that's what they were.
We just have a couple of minutes left here. So I wonder, where is all this today? And has anyone effectively put a stop to this?
No one has put a stop to it effectively. They keep arresting them in the cities where they are. One of the things that has happened, though, is due to simply the enormous spread of heroin and heroin addiction in America, and that is that what they in many towns where they used to operate almost solely or with a little competition. Now, due to the fact that there's across the underworld, everybody knows there's a heroin demand for heroin. So that has meant the numbers of heroin dealers has proliferated just extraordinarily all across the place. In Cincinnati, there's huge numbers of new dealers, younger guys now on the streets, and just like they used to sell crack, black guys out there on the streets now all over certain parts of Cincinnati, for example, where these guys really in the early 2000s. Were kind of almost alone. Now they share the market with a whole bunch of other folks. Plus, the expansion of the number of addicts means that with every addict, of course, you get a potential heroin dealer, because frequently the only way to make your nut for your addiction every day is to sell the dope itself and take part of it for your own addiction, because working is very difficult at that point. And so for every addict you create, you also create a potential dealer. And what that means, all of this means, is that the areas that these guys used to have almost to themselves, or relatively speaking, there wasn't a whole lot of extra competition. Now there's a whole lot more. And that's what's really changed for these guys in the towns where they are.
Hey, Sam, this has been great. Unfortunately, we're down to our last minute here. I just wonder if you could tell us why you think there are so many overdoses. We just have a minute or so. Is that because of the additives to the heroin? Is it because
No.
of the people just don't know what they're doing, what they're getting?
Yes.
What?
I think, and also every addict, if you talk to them, you will find every addict wants to take it to the very, very last point where death might occur. That's what you're looking for. That's what heroin's about. Take it to the limit. People talk about how their heroin is great because somebody just died from it the other day. Now, the guys that I talk about, the Jalisco boys, don't want their folks to die because they want them to be clients forever. You know, they keep them from stopping, too. They want to give them free dope to keep them from stopping. But most of the time, I think what happens is people just don't know what they're doing, or frequently they're in jail or they're in some kind of treatment without any medically assisted treatment. They come out, they've done it kind of cold turkey. And they relapse, they get back into it, and they use the same amount of drugs, heroin, that they use when they were using regularly, and your body can't take it. The tolerance has diminished significantly, and they die. And so I think there's a whole lot of combinations of all of that, but that someone is selling bad dope, sometimes that's the case. I think more than likely it's just simply people. When you get into heroin, what you really want to do is be as high as possible. And sometimes that takes you into a place where everything shuts down and your respiratory system stops working and you die.
Sam, it's been nice to spend this hour with you. It's a great work here. A fascinating, disturbing story. Really, emphasis on the fascinating. Thank you very much, Sam.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yep. Sam Quinones, journalist and author of the book we've been discussing in this hour. The show is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Bloomsbury Press is the publisher of Sam's book. Sam is based in California. Hope you enjoy today's program. Please come back in 22 hours for another edition of Midday.